I'm Jesse Thorne. You're listening to The Turnaround, the show where I interview interviewers about interviewing. It's produced by MaximumFun.org, presented in partnership with CJR, the Columbia Journalism Review. This episode of the show, Jerry Springer. You probably know him as a daytime television icon. He's so much more than that. He was originally a politician and a lawyer. He was mayor of Cincinnati for a while in the late 1970s. After he left politics, a local TV station approached him to basically be a talking head. After a few years, he got into daytime talk, doing a kind of Donahue show. And then, somewhere along the line, things got bonkers. Like, for example, here is a clip from Jerry Springer, 1993, height of his powers. A fight just broke out on stage. And at the time, they did not even have the security guys on the show that they have now.
The test is going to be whether we can continue for an hour to talk about this. Every society in the world can reach for a gun and settle a dispute. Our so-called ideal, which tonight we're going to go home and each of us talk to our kids about, is going to be whether or not we can have such freedom in this country that we can even talk about things that hurt us, that things that we're angry about, things we hate. We can even talk without punching each other out. That's what the test is. I'm not asking anybody to change their mind on any issue, and you will have all your chance to talk. But let's try and do it without hitting each other, okay? Please don't come into our home and punch each other out, okay? That's not going to be allowed, all right? It's not going to be allowed.
Now, you probably have an idea of what the Jerry Springer Show is. And frankly, you know, in large part, that's probably correct. I mean, Jerry Springer would probably agree with you. It is sort of lowest common denominator, hyper-dramatic reality theater. I mean, it is a bonkers television show. A guy did come on to talk about marrying his horse. All of that is real. But Jerry, the guy in the middle of all of it, the ringmaster, he also understands that part of what makes the show a success is that those people who are on the show are people who otherwise would not have a voice in our society. In fact, giving them a microphone is a kind of strange act of empowerment.
You know, it's one thing to interview a celebrity because they have the skills, they know how to present themselves, they know exactly what they're doing and how to turn a question into an answer they want to give. When you're talking to someone who has never been on stage, makeup on, bright lights, screaming audience, that's pretty powerful. That can shake someone up. And it's also ennobling in that so many of the guests we have never get asked their opinion on anything.
He's the man in the middle of it all, Jerry Springer. Let's get into our conversation. Jerry Springer, welcome to The Turnaround. Thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. You were a television anchorman early in your career.
Right.
Did you get into that job because you wanted to go into journalism?
No. I had, for 10 years, I was city councilman and mayor of Cincinnati, and then went, I couldn't run again, NBC offered me a job to anchor their news on the NBC affiliate there in Cincinnati, figuring that if I had been a councilman and mayor for 10 years, that I knew the city and therefore might have some credibility. And so I'd never even thought about it, but they offered me the job, and I didn't know yet if, you know, I would run again for another office or something like that. So I figured, well, I'll give it a shot. And basically, that's how I got it. It was handed to me. I was nearing the end of my term, and they came, took me to lunch one day and said, when you're done, we'd like you to do that. I wasn't so interested in anchoring. I was more interested in doing political commentary. So we worked out a deal that I would agree to anchor the news at what turned out to be 5:36 and 11. But at the end of every newscast, I could do a 2-minute commentary on something that happened in the news that day. And that kind of became the staple, and it became, you know, I guess popular or whatever in Cincinnati for 10 years. And that's how I wound up getting a talk show.
That's interesting. I mean, it's rare to end up in a journalistic job like that when your interest is doing commentary. I mean, especially in broadcast journalism, mostly people are reporters. Was it weird to be in a situation where, you know, your colleagues and to some extent the people who you were in charge of on the show, because somewhat the anchor is in charge of a show like that, were people who'd reported on you as a politician?
Yeah, it was, well, the politics of it, the small p politics of it, was such that the NBC affiliate was last in the ratings. So basically the company was thinking this may be something to grab some attention. And it was unique at the time. In fact, there were obviously stations had editorials and stuff like that, but that was normally given by the general manager or the station manager of the and he would or she would come on at the end and do a commentary. But you never crossed the line of having someone who was doing the news for an hour at the end giving his opinion. That was something new. In fact, there was only one other person in the country doing it. I think the fellow's name was Walt Jacobson out of Chicago. So that was a brand new thing, and they decided to give it a try. None of us knew if it would work, and it wasn't like I was looking to have a career in journalism, so I certainly was willing to do it, and either it worked or it didn't, and I wasn't thinking that this would be something I would do the rest of my life. But it took off, and I had a really, even though I'm, you know, very liberal in my politics, this was the 1980s, so this was Ronald Reagan. I really worked hard at not letting my personal politics seep into the news. And you have to consciously do that. I assume there's always going to be some kind of ultimate bias, but the only difference between me and every other journalist is that you knew where I stood. You know, with every other journalist, you don't know because they don't announce it. So there wasn't anything that was substantively different, but at least the appearance was different, and I was conscious of that. So, like, when I was talking about Reagan, I wasn't rolling my eyes doing the news. And then if I had something to say about what he was doing or what was happening in Washington, then I would save that for my commentary. And it, you know, Cincinnati's a conservative city. And so, obviously, if it was totally slanted, it wouldn't have worked. People wouldn't have watched, and the station would have suffered. So there was also that kind of pressure to keep it straight. And we became pretty dominant in the ratings, and I suspect it wound up working. It was pure luck. No one knew ahead of time. It wasn't like I had this great idea. I was just offered a job and did it, and I got to enjoy it. And it was 10 really good years, exciting times. And then the company that owned the station, the NBC affiliate, where I did the news every night, also owned talk shows. It was multimedia. And they owned Phil Donahue, Sally Jesser, Raphael, etc. And Phil was getting close to retirement. So one day the CEO of multimedia took me to lunch and said, Phil's going to retire and we're going to start a new talk show and you're going to host it. So I was assigned it as an employee. It wasn't anything that I ever had any interest in. I can't even remember ever watching talk shows, daytime talk shows. I mean, you know, if you were grown up and you had a job, you probably were working during the day, and it's just nothing I had any particular interest in. And so that, too, was handed to me. So basically, you know, I have had this lucky life where the only job I ever applied for in life was, you know, running for mayor. Obviously, you apply for that. But short of that, everything else has been, in a sense, handed to me. Someone sees what you're doing, they're, for whatever reason, attracted to it or happy with it, and so they offered a job. And That's the lucky life I've had.
The initial show, the syndicated show that you hosted, was in the vein of Donahue or Sally, Jesse, Raphael, or the shows that were, you know, just starting to really take off on syndicated TV at the time. What kind of things did you cover on the show?
Oh, well, in the beginning, we did a normal talk show, and because my interest is more political, you know, we had like Jesse Jackson, Oliver North, stuff like that, and once in a while we had celebrities. It was, look, in the beginning, when I started in 1991 with the talk show, there were 20 talk shows, daytime talk shows on the air, and everyone was trying to be like Oprah, appealing to the demographic, which at that time was referred to as middle-aged housewives. And so they all did the same thing. We all did the same thing. And then along came Ricky Lake, and hers was the first daytime talk show that went after the kids. And when I say kids, I mean high school and college age. And I just thought, we had been on the air now with our talk show for about 2 or 3 years, and I remember walking down Michigan Avenue with my executive producer, and we were talking about it, and I just said, as a business model, why are we trying to be one out of 20 shows and copy Oprah? Why not go after Ricky's Lake's audience, the young, you know, the kids, and just be one out of two, and we'll get a much larger piece of the pie. And so literally the very next day we said, from now on, we only have young people in the audience, young people on stage, young subject matter. Well, as you know, young people are much more open in their lifestyles, much wilder and crazier at times. So every once in a while, not every day, but every once in a while, the show did go crazy. Then Universal bought us. And when Universal bought us, they said, from now on, you can only do crazy. And that's how the show got to be what it is. If you call us with a warm, uplifting story, we're not allowed to run it. We're required to send it to another show. And the producers have given a list of these other shows. And based on subject matter, that's the show we send it to. But we're only allowed to do those things that are inappropriate, outside social norms, etc. And so that every day I go in, I can't be complaining. I know they're going to hand me something crazy.
What was the first time that it, as you put it, went crazy and you noticed, you're like, this is kind of a different thing?
Well, the first time it went crazy, it was scary because we didn't have any security. We did a show on the Klan and the Ku Klux Klan, and literally a riot broke out. Some people from the audience charged the stage, and for about 15 minutes, people were fighting. We called the police and everything, and it was calmed down. My thought at that moment was, well, there goes the talk show. You know, career over, that's finished. And instead, the reaction from the company was, well, from now on, starting the very next day, we're going to have security here during the show. And so that's when the local police were hired, off-duty cops, as being our security. And, you know, one of them, Steve, you know, became very popular and, you know, a good friend. And, you know, the young people all, you know, looked at him, this good-looking guy and all that. And so now, you know, we produce his show. But that's how that happened. So it wasn't like none of this was planned. The only decision that was ever made by me was, let's go young. And then when, as I said, Universal bought us, they made the corporate decision that we go crazy.
When that decision got made, did you think about the fact that you were committing your life to doing crazy stuff every day indefinitely?
No. I mean, first of all, the show's the show, and it's not like I'm committing my life to it. It's a job, and it's not anything. It's never become the most important thing in my life at all. It's fun to do, and I don't mind. You know, I enjoy doing it. Obviously, I'm still doing it, but it's never been my passion. My passion is, you know, other than obviously my family, my passion is more political. Those are That's what I care about. And that's what I spend most of my time doing, traveling around the country and a lot of time in Ohio, raising money, giving political speeches and stuff like that. So that's what I spend my time doing. And 2 days a week, I tape five shows. And it's fun to do. I don't I realize how lucky I am to have this job. But it's not anything I am emotionally invested in. I knew the show was the show, and that's my job. If I was hired to host a show about basketball, every day I would have basketball players on. If I was doing a show about serial murderers, then every day I would have serial murders on. When I was doing the news, we had one horrible story after another. No one ever would suggest that because an anchor reports or does stories about news and chooses those stories to put on the air, that therefore those news people have endorsed crime. That's what your job is. When you're a judge, you're not allowed to say, you know what, I don't like criminals, so please don't send me any criminals. You do what your job entails, and I enjoy it. Obviously, I don't need to make a living at my age anymore, but I just keep doing it because it's fun, and obviously enough people like it to keep it going. We're 27 years now. But, you know, I never tell people, boy, you ought to watch this show. You know, if I were in high school or college, yeah, I know I would watch because it's kind of like a fraternity party. But, you know, people my age don't watch this stuff, so... And that's my feeling about the show. I enjoy doing it. I like it. But it's not my taste. It's not something I would ever watch.
When you show up to the office on a taping day, what do you get handed before the show starts? Like, what do you know about?
I'm not allowed to know what the show's about. So the only thing I get handed is the card that you see me carrying around during the show. But all the card has on it are the names of the guests, because I haven't met them. I don't know who they are. And so my job is to ask questions that you would ask sitting at home watching and then make jokes. So basically I'm hired to keep it going and make jokes. That's why every segment always starts with me introducing the name of the guest and then saying, so what's going on? And then they start telling me their story, and just like you're doing as an interviewer, I just then start asking questions that come to mind that I would ask if I were, as I said, sitting at home watching, and then try to make jokes. So I'm always trying to think of quips and how to make this lighter and funny or whatever. And that's what I'm paid to do. I'm paid to be funny when I'm on the air. But I never know what the subject matter is. They keep that separate, because if they told me ahead of time what's going to be presented, then any reaction I had would be fake, because I would already know what's going to happen. So how could I fake surprise? You know, it would look awful. So this is much better, and it keeps me more engaged in the subject, because, you know, for that hour that we're on, I really got to be focused. I've got to listen exactly what they're saying. And you're not dealing with professional entertainers here. You're mostly 95% of the time, if not more, you're dealing with someone who's never been on television before, has never been in front of a crowd before. And, you know, it's one thing to interview a celebrity because they have the skills, they know how to present themselves, they know exactly what they're doing and how to turn a question into an answer they want to give. When you're talking to someone who has never been on stage, makeup on, bright lights, screaming audience, that's pretty powerful. That can shake someone up. And it's also ennobling in that so many of the guests we have never get asked their opinion on anything. Some of us who have, you know, many of us who have wonderful jobs, you know, you're asked every day your opinion on something. Whether it's at home, you know, so many of our guests, they don't have kids who listen to them. They don't have a spouse who listens to them. They don't have a boss who listens to them. They don't, you know, no one ever asks their What's important to you? What do you think we should do in this situation? And say, and now, for the first time in their lives, my gosh, they're on stage. You know, they get flown to where we do the show now, Stamford, Connecticut. They get put up in a hotel. They come to the studio. They get makeup. They meet the producers. They come out on stage. People are cheering, whatever the reaction is. And it's like, wow. You know, because you and I, in many of these stories they tell, you say, oh, my gosh, I can't believe they're saying this stuff. And then they get involved in a heated situation. And when the show is over and they're standing around, you know, backstage asking for pictures, and Jerry, will you hold my kid while I snap a picture, and what's a good restaurant to go to around here? They're like everybody else. And they always ask, can we come back on? You know, it's, and that made me think, wow, we take this microphone and the attention for granted. And for many people, this just is never a part of their lives. And it's pretty exciting that once in their life, someone is paying attention to what they're saying.
What do you do to keep the conversation moving, as you described it? What's your...
I'm a regular person. They're telling me something and I'm going to... What do you say when you meet someone? You start talking to them. You meet someone at a party. They're talking. And then if they say something, it leads to the next question. I mean, it's just a normal conversation. Look, I totally know that we're all alike. Some of us just dress better. Some of us maybe had better luck in the gene pool of parents. You know, some of us maybe were lucky and were born with a more agile brain or whatever. But basically, we're all alike. We all want to be happy. We all get upset when things don't go our way. Sometimes people have more of an education so they can use better language in being upset. But it's like, I never go into a show thinking that I'm better than the people on the show. I'm just luckier. And if you just remember that we're all the same, then you will just talk to someone like you every day. When you go to lunch and you run into someone, you don't say to yourself, gosh, what am I going to talk about? You just talk. And it's just... You know, and so there's no magic to it. I'm just a regular person. I'm a schlub that got lucky. So I just talk like I would talk to anybody.
I had an interaction once with a city councilman here in Los Angeles named Tom Labonge at the Frame store.
Yes.
And Tom Labonge, I think he represented, I believe he recently retired, but he represented a district neighboring mine. He wasn't my councilman, but... I had this extended interaction with him before I realized that he was City Councilman Tom Labonge. And it was remarkable because it occurred to me afterwards that a significant part of his career was having this kind of, like, choosing to engage in an interaction with a stranger, sort of having a lively conversation. And this is just in the passing of his life. You know, he was at the frame shop to pick up some stuff that he had gotten framed.
Sure. Right.
And I'm just sitting there trying to figure out why this guy has – why there's a man in the frame shop with an assistant telling his assistant different things, and who is clearly not a Hollywood guy. And it occurred to me that after this interaction and thinking about it retrospectively, thinking about you, that, like, in a way, the skill set that you use on your show is not that wildly unlike the skill set that that a bread and butter, meat and potatoes politician has, which you were for a long time, which is to say, you walk into the situation and you try and make sure that everyone feels like they've been heard and had a pleasant interaction with you.
That's exactly right. That's really perceptive of you. And that is, my constituency has never changed in any part of my life. You know, I grew up and I still thankfully have the same friends that I had as a kid. And so we talk naturally to each other. And then, you know, you go away to college and you're talking with your fraternity brothers and your college friends. And then all of a sudden, I was immediately well, I first went into the civil rights movement and then the anti-war movement. So I was in politics first. And so you're right. And when you're in politics, you just talk every day to regular people. And then from there, I go to the news and you're covering stories with regular people every day. You know, you're going into the neighborhood. Something happened in this neighborhood. There's a town meeting. You're covering it. And then obviously my show, it's regular people. I'm less comfortable talking with celebrities, and we don't permit any more celebrities on our show, well, at least for the last 25 years. If you're known, you can't be on the show because, you know, they understandably they will have an agenda or presentation of self that they've really worked on, and it's tough to break through that. But you just – so, right, I've always just talked to regular people because I'm just a regular schlub myself. You know, we just have different jobs. And if that's the, it's not really a skill set other than talking, I guess, is a skill set, but you learn that in the fifth grade. I always say, and it's God's truth, I don't have any particular talent. I mean, I think I'm a nice guy and I'm reasonably bright, but I don't have a talent. No one would pick me out of the high school yearbook and say, this guy's going to be in show business. I mean, there's nothing that I have that you would put in a talent category. And yet I've had this very successful life in show business. And so it's because of social media and television and talk shows, which basically was the beginning. Well, talk radio really was the beginning of social media in a sense, that the audience became the entertainment. And we, the people listening, listened to our own calls and enjoyed that. That is what has now taken place in society, that regular people, we are the entertainment. It's not a few people sitting, with few exceptions, in Hollywood or New York deciding who the next stars are going to be. We vote for the next stars. We decide what our entertainment is. It's very democratic. There'll be some that complain and say, well, the level of talent isn't as great, but it's democratic. We decide. We vote the people off the island. You know, and sadly, this has resulted in a Trump presidency. But that's the skill set. But it's not really a talent. It's just people being regular and loving authenticity. There's the word. That's what it is. Authenticity. If you're real, you don't have to be good looking. You don't have to be rich. You don't. If it's authentic, people will go for it.
Do you walk off stage at the end of taping a show and have a feeling like, oh, that was a good one. Oh, that wasn't a good one?
Yeah, but it's based on it's based on the personality of the guests. You know, it's never. Our show's a little bit different because it isn't like, boy, did we produce a great show. If the guests have a great personality and or an interesting personality and you're really engaged in it because it's either funny or it's crazy or for whatever reason, yeah, that's, you can kind of tell, wow, that was good. That was a good show. And then if I'm talking a lot during the show, it's not a good show because that's me trying to keep it going because it's not going, it's not organic on its own. And the magic of the show would be if I'm not there. No one's watching the show because of me. They're watching the show because, wow, did you see that? What's that? You know, that's what makes it go. So that's how I can tell if it's been a good show. But if I'm having to talk a lot and just keep asking more questions and more questions, then I realize it's not spontaneously happening.
We'll be right back with more of my talk with Jerry Springer on The Turnaround.
Mugs, shirts, stickers, patches, tanks, and more are yours for the purchasing at MaxFunStore.com. Hey, you already love the podcasts, so why not take this to the next level and outfit your home and bod with our merch? MaxFunStore.com. Because if you have to wear a shirt, it should be one of ours.
Following the news is hard and it sucks.
How do you know which stories are important?
Which sources do you trust in this post-truth world of reactionary journalism?
I'm Brett Black.
And I'm Travis McElroy.
And we host a podcast called Trends Like These.
We cover trending news stories.
We debunk misleading clickbait headlines.
And we always try to throw in a little bit of good news.
In our quest for truth!
So join us every week on MaximumFun.org or wherever podcasts are found.
You're listening to The Turnaround. My guest on this program, daytime talk show host Jerry Springer. Do you have a feeling when you walk off the stage about whether you did or did not do a good job?
No. I mean, what would a good job be? I mean, you know, if I tell this one joke and it really works, you know, go, oh, wow, they thought that was funny. You know, and I'm, you know, we laugh as I'm going off the stage. You know, some of the security guys will come up and they're always teasing me and say, you know, man, you killed. That was funny. You're on fire. You know, all that silly stuff. So, no, it's not like I'm this singer and, you know, wow, what a performance I gave. You know, I'm an announcer that has quips,
you know,
based on the situation.
Do you get surprised by what happens still?
Well, sure. Well, there are two answers to that. The first is you can't be a grown-up in today's world and be surprised by anything anymore. Okay, so that's disingenuous for anyone that says, oh my gosh, there is nothing that has ever taken place on a television show now that a grown-up doesn't know exists in the world. There's nothing that has ever been on a television show that isn't already in the Bible, that isn't already in Shakespeare, that isn't in great literature. You know, it's all there. And now we may be surprised that something happens to someone we know, but there is no situation I could describe for you where you would honestly say to me, I didn't know that could happen. You know what I mean? So I can't say, oh my gosh, I can't believe this situation. No. All you have to do is read any newspaper in America today or go to any, you know, website or, you know, Huffington Post or whatever. And, you know, in a newspaper, by the time you get to page 3, I've got 20 shows. So there's nothing that has ever been on that isn't in our everyday lives that we see it happening somewhere in the world. You know, in my lifetime, we've had a Holocaust, World War, Vietnam, assassinations. You know, what's shocking anymore?
But at the same time, I mean, part of your job is managing a kind of complicated... I mean, on the one hand, in some ways, it's simple for a television show because it's, you know, there's only a few signposts, right? You have one person walks out, you hear their story. The other person walks out, you hear their story. Sometimes a third or fourth person is added to that, or sometimes there's a reveal of some kind, right? Like, it's a real simple dramatic structure, but you have to manage it in a pretty short amount of time. You have the help from producers and stuff who are there. And I wonder if you are ever just left on the wrong foot, you know what I mean?
No, the only because they don't tell me, well, I'm always left on the wrong foot because I never know. But one time I really was on the wrong foot. We had this show, which is one of our more well-known shows, I guess. We had this guy who married his horse. He lived outside of Branson, Missouri, and his home had extra wide hallways because the horse lived inside with him. Anyway, he married his horse, and that was the story. But, of course, I didn't know that. So the show starts as they all start. There's this guy. I don't remember what his name is. Let's say it's Bob. There's Bob sitting on the chair on stage, and I say, hey, Bob, what's going on? That's always my first question. And Bob says, well, Jer, I'm having trouble with my neighbors. Well, what's wrong? They don't like my wife. Why don't they like your wife? He says, I don't know. She keeps to herself. She's quiet. You know, she doesn't start any arguments. And, well, I can see this is going no place. So I look down at my card, and I see the next guest. The next name is Pixel. I said, well, okay, let's meet Pixel. Out comes this horse. The crowd goes wild. I start saying, oh, my God, stop the cameras, because I'm thinking that the wife fell off the horse backstage, that the horse just came out. It wouldn't dawn on me, or why would it dawn on anyone, that his wife was the horse? You know. So then the producer is yelling from the side, no, that's his wife. And which is why I have one of the best jobs in the world, because here's the reason. Let's say I could go to lunch, or I could go to, let's say, to dinner with anyone who would go out to dinner with me, let's say, and we're sitting at dinner, and I'd say, hey, how was your day? And you'll tell me about your day, and it was a tough day at the office. A funny thing happened by the water cooler, and you tell me the story, and we'll chuckle about it. Yeah, that was weird. And then you'll say, well, Jerry, how was your day? And I'll say, well, I got this guy who married his horse. I'm always going to have the better story. And that's what makes this such a fascinating job. I mean, what haven't I heard?
You know, it's funny, Jerry. Like, one of the questions that I've asked a lot of people is, what is the question that you ask when you can't think of what to ask? And I read an interview where you described that you only had a couple of things to say on the show, which were like,
right.
And it seemed
like my three questions. But go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it seemed like basically the question that you have that you can always ask, it's one that you've identified, is, wait, you did what?
Yeah. my three questions are, you did what? Come on out. We'll be right back. If you can say those three lines, you can be a talk show host.
Well, I mean, it depends on how good your segment producers are.
Yeah. Well, it's that's true. But that's honestly, it is not a difficult job. I mean, I've had real jobs in life. Being mayor, that's a real job. You know, being a journalist, that's a real job. Being a talk show host, you're the maitre d' at a restaurant. That's what, you know, you're showing people to their seats and making sure everyone's okay. And it's not, it's just not a difficult job. And I don't want to make it seem like it's a really big, oh, wow, boy, the burdens I have. You have no idea.
But Jerry,
there's no relationship.
I hear you.
Yep.
I hear you 100% on that. And I believe you to some extent.
Why? Because I was a politician. You can't go all the way.
I mostly believe you.
Go ahead.
But I think that there's a little bit of perhaps sincere or perhaps false modesty when you describe that there's no talent involved in what you do, and maybe barely a skill set. Because it seems to me like your greatest job on the show is to make everyone who is there feel like they are being heard and feel like they are being represented fairly and to some extent warmly. I mean, no matter what the crazy thing is that's happening on that show, that while you may have a perspective about it, that you will share at the end of the show, you're not going to pick on them or be a jerk about it, even if it's something abhorrent.
Yeah, but that, okay, look, I have a healthy ego, and there are things that I think I'm really good at and I will debate, et cetera, and that is in the political arena. I have very liberal politics, and boy, I go for that. I don't step back at all on those issues. But I also recognize that when I'm doing this show, I'm not being falsely humble. I'm just doing what my mother taught me and all our mothers taught us. 95% of the people I know in this world are nice. And we're all nice to each other. Well, I'm not judgmental. That's true. I am not judgmental because I realize, oh, my gosh, you know, when I say we're all alike, I really mean that. And, you know, I didn't grow up with money. I didn't grow up being, you know, in a family of fame. No one knew who I was. I'm an immigrant. You know, and I had my five friends in high school like everyone else. You go back to a high school reunion of mine, no one remembers that I was in that high school. You know, they know who I am now. But so I'm just behaving like all my friends behave. And if someone is being a jerk, they're no longer your friends. You know, think about it. If someone in your circle is suddenly acting like a jerk, you just don't hang around with that person anymore. So it's not unique how I'm behaving. When I talk to people on my show, that's how I would talk to someone in a frame shop, you know, or in Starbucks. You meet someone. Hey, how you doing? You see that they drop something? You help them pick it up. Yeah, you know, you see an older person trying to get through the door, you help them. That's just being a normal person like we all are. You go to a ball game, virtually everyone except the people that get drunk is nice. So that's what I mean. It's not a talent. You just, if you're not judgmental and you realize that we're all alike, then of course I'm not going to act like a jerk because I'd be embarrassed to be a jerk. And my mom would have punished me. And that's how we're all raised.
Do you feel like the way that you approach the world was changed by the fact that, you know, you were involved in a big public morality scandal when you were a politician?
Oh, no. I mean, what are you referring to, the writing a check at a massage parlor? Yeah, but I was in. No. I mean, no, because that, truthfully, in today's world, that wasn't a real big deal, and it was 5 years before I ever became mayor. I was in my mid-20s. So I did something I shouldn't have done, you know.
That's also how you
I don't view that 50 years later like, oh, my gosh, you know, that was an embarrassing evening, and I shouldn't have done it. And
I don't mean the incident itself, Jerry. I'm talking about the way that it – I mean, at the time – you sort of engaged with it, then, as far as I know, I wasn't there at the time, but in the way that you're engaging with it now, which is very frankly, which was relatively unusual for a conservative town politician in the 70s.
I decided to resign from council, and no one knew why I resigned. So the next day I held a press conference. I said, the reason I resigned is that I went to a massage parlor and, you know, a happy ending. I don't know, however you want to phrase it. And I shouldn't have done that. But I don't ever want to be in the position where someone could blackmail me in the future. Oh, we're going to tell what you did and all that. And I was admittedly young, so I didn't yet have perspective that in light of all the things that go on in the world, people aren't going to sleep at night, not being able to sleep because, oh, that guy went to a massage parlor. You know, it's, in other words, with the passing years, you start to put things like that in your perspective. So in answer to your question, has that had any impact on how I view the world? No. How you're raised, that has an impact. You know, being raised to have good manners, I don't curse, I don't fight, I don't steal, I don't drink. I don't even do drugs, and you know, which is not what the audience of the show wants to hear. But you know, it's like I'm really kind of in my lifestyle, kind of conservative, like I guess Cincinnati was. But whatever, I can't honestly say and make a dramatic story about how that really gave me a view of what the world is like and how I should behave. And no, the non-judgmental thing came from being raised by parents who, you know, we've had real disasters. My family was exterminated in the camps of Nazi Germany. You know, there are real issues in the life that happen in families, and that puts everything in perspective. Maybe that's what gives you a worldview. It's hard for me to be upset about anything that happens because whatever is happening is small potatoes compared to some of the things we went through in the world, you know, before.
The other thing that I think you do a really amazing job of is maintaining a tone on your show where, you know, some really like extraordinarily dramatic things happen a couple of times in every episode of your program, right?
Right.
People find out life-changing revelations. People throw cups of water on each other. You know, people start to get in fights and are pulled away from each other. You know, there's these grand dramatic things.
Yes.
And as you said, you know, your show is, you know, ultimately, I think for most people who watch it, it's a goof. You know, it's a...
it's a circus. Yeah.
And that is something that I imagine you have to be aware of, or at least you have to have been aware of early on, which is how do we build this show where this crazy stuff is happening and it doesn't just make people feel bad?
Well, the thing is, the only thing I had told the station, whatever, I mean the show, the company, whatever, is I don't want to deal with any life-changing issues. In other words, we don't do pregnancy tests. We don't do, you know, who's the father and stuff like that. That's too serious. That changes someone's life. We have shows where people get angry, but it's about dating. Their girlfriend is going out with another guy, you know. And they're angry, but the next day they're dating someone else. So we don't do any serious, serious issues.
That's interesting,
and
Jerry. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I was watching...
Yeah.
The very thing that I was thinking about, I was watching someone else's show when I was getting my hair cut at the barbershop a couple months ago, and it was a paternity test show.
I don't do that. I'm not condemning people that do. I'm not comfortable with that.
Well, it made me really sad. Like watching the show.
Yeah.
Made me feel. I mean, there was other dudes in the barbershop who were like taking sides and having a great time. And, you know, bully to them, I guess. But, like, I was just looking at this, man, this kid and it turned out to be his stepdad. And I was just bummed out for this, you know, the kid whose guy was maybe 19 or 20.
Yeah.
And it really ate me up. And one of the parts of your job is to have enough levity and enough lightness and gentleness to the show that even though people are doing ridiculous things, that it can be enjoyable and the conflicts don't ever feel sad.
Yeah. Well, that's why we don't, you know, I don't want to do that. That's just me. And I'm not comfortable doing that. And I let them know. And so we don't do, you know, pregnancy tests or life changing issues. Even when they're surprises, the people are given a list of the potential possible surprises ahead of time, which they have to agree to. They have to initial every one of them. Now, they don't know which of the 21, I think the list has 21 possible surprises. They don't know which of the 21 it's going to be, but they've agreed that they'll accept any one of them on the show and then not say, gee, I wouldn't have come on the show if I knew it was this. We did that from day one simply because we don't want people that are on our show to be angry with us. I mean, you know, what's the point of that? You know, you'll have a short-lived show. So we don't – no, we won't take any really serious issue. Now, sometimes people come to me and say, Jerry, could you put this on your show? It's a really serious issue and I want to – first of all, any serious issue, we would be disrespecting it by putting it on our show. We can't have a circus every day and then tomorrow I'm talking about people with cancer. You know, it's like, what? So the show is a circus. It is a circus. If there's something else you want to put on television, you then go to another show. And if it's a really serious issue, I would say it doesn't belong on television. You've got a serious problem. You go to a doctor, psychiatrist, psychologist, whatever, a counselor. But you don't go to a TV show host. You know, we're not trained for that. You know, you can't take someone's life. And you know, just, you know, any issue that can be solved in a one-hour television show is by definition not a very serious issue. So I just don't – that's not anything I'm interested in doing. I don't want to do it. I'm not comfortable with it. So I don't get into that problem with how can I be funny in this situation because we don't have, you know, horrible situations.
I read you just say one time that when you have nightmares, your nightmares are about not having a job. Was that hyperbolic or was that sincere?
Hyperbolic, because I don't remember my dreams, which may be a problem. Maybe I ought to go to a counselor. No, what I worry, it was a way of saying there is, and actually I've heard this later on, but after I had spoken about that, at some place I read an article, it is the insecurity that Holocaust survivors have. In other words, I always think it can be taken away. So here I am, 73 years old, and working as hard as I've ever worked. Because I just don't do the show. I also do I do my weekly podcast. By the way, go to Jerry Springer Podcast, Google it. And so I do my podcast. I do the national tour of The Price is Right, where we do it in theaters and casinos around the country. I have a full political schedule in terms of speeches and raising money and organizing. So I really work hard. And at the age of 73, obviously financially, I don't need to do it anymore. But I am psychologically or emotionally afraid of not being out there working or making a living. And, my wife, we've been married forever, 44 years, and known each other for 50. And she realizes that. So there is no talk about when you're going to retire. She understands that I'm not that good at golf. So I'm great on a vacation for 2 weeks. But then if I knew that I couldn't go back to doing a job, I would feel insecure. And I know that. It's not healthy. But that I've got to know that I got a place to go with responsibility to do something.
Do you feel like you always were the kind of guy that wanted to make people around him feel comfortable? You think that was like a constitution?
I am non-confrontational. That is true. There was never any yelling in our house. No one ever cursed, but that was old-time European, upbringing, the idea that there would be curse words in our house in front of my mother or anything. You know, the world has changed. You know, I was raised, if a woman walked into the room, I had to stand up. And if it was an elder, I couldn't be sitting there on the floor. I had to stand up. And, my friends would make fun of me because I was this kid that came from Europe and had all these manners kind of things. So it's all part of your upbringing, I believe.
It's funny because I was thinking, like, I in my other job on my NPR show, Bullseye, I interview artists and entertainers and culture makers. And a lot of comedians have circumstances in their lives where they spend their childhoods coming up with strategies to grease the wheels of social interaction, whatever it is. I mean, sometimes it's as simple as they were really small. But
yeah, certainly, well, I was, this is good. I was, now that you mention it, I was the shortest kid in my class forever. I was 6 feet tall, but at my age, I'm probably down to 5'11". You know, you start shrinking when you get my age. But I went through adulthood at 6 feet. But when I graduated high school, I was 5'2". I did all my growing in college and law school. I grew very late. My dad was only 5'1" at the very tallest he ever was. So I came to America when I was 5, and with a bloody British accent, and my mom dressed me in short pants, a jacket, a bow tie, a beret, and knee socks in New York with, as I said, a bloody British accent. And obviously I was teased and all that. So I did probably create strategies to, be accepted, because I became very conscious that I wasn't one of the guys. And so I became obsessed with baseball because this is New York in 1949. And, you know, if you were in New York for boys, baseball was everything. It was the only sport on, well, most people didn't have televisions yet, but that was the sport. And New York had three baseball teams, the Yankees, the Brooklyn Dodgers, and the New York Giants. And so that's what kids talked about and played all the time. And I became obsessed with it and, you know, memorized all the statistics. And when we did finally get a television set, I would turn the sound off. And my dad got me this little rotary tape recorder, and I would announce the games, you know, as a 11-year-old in front of my TV set announcing the games because I turned the sound off. I don't know, you know, too bad we don't have those tapes anymore. It would have been lovely.
I did that too, Jerry.
Yeah, well, there you go. You must be short. No. So, but I understand that. I understand that with comedians, and it's a way you start to, and then, you know, in some cases, I was the class clown. I mean, I was always making jokes and stuff like that because getting a laugh was an affirmation that, hey, I'm one of the guys. I'm not very big. I'm not strong. And I was reasonably smart. So, you know, with the big jocks, I would do their homework as I got older and stuff like that and their papers and, you know, to fit in. So, yeah, if you put me on a couch, put me under, that probably would come out. I think that's a fair assessment. But just being polite and nice and not wanting confrontation, that's just good manners. But it's like all my friends, honestly, I am no different than my friends who are very regular people. And most of them are funnier than I am.
Is it weird that you go, like, a big part of your life is interactions with people where you start with something to dispense of the biggest part of your public persona? I mean, like, the first thing that you said to me when we started talking to each other was jokingly, I apologize for my show.
It's an icebreaker. It's an icebreaker. I wanted, you know, just to set the tone that, and I notice I do that because, you know, and it's also disarming in a sense. I recognize that. There's nothing anyone can say about the show that I don't agree with. You know, the show's stupid. And I know that. And it's not meant to be, you know, a great piece of literature or art. It's like chewing gum. It doesn't do anything for you and, you know, it won't kill you, but it won't do anything for you. It's a 1-hour escape from whatever is going on in your life, I guess. So, you know, that then gets us at a level playing field where the conversation isn't defending a show that I admit I'm on your, it is crazy. And I say, I don't watch it. My wife or my sister, or, you know, they don't watch it. But kids during school, you know, at school age, they watched it.
Do you think you would have run for office again if you hadn't fallen into this line of work?
Oh, what? It's a separate decision. If I run for office, you know, I mean, obviously the question's been answered. We have Donald Trump as president, so one doesn't exclude the other for sure. It's a matter of energy now, whether I physically could throw myself into that again. That's what I have to think about.
Are you happy that you ended up doing this in 1991 and 1993?
I have had such a wonderful life. I mean, it would be arrogant and really, yeah, for me to say, oh, boy, I've had it so bad. Why did I do that? And, you know, who wouldn't want this life? And it's given me an opportunity to do so many things. Even politically. I mean, let's face it. You know, who's paying attention to what a local city councilman says, you know, nationwide? But here I get to go on all these political cable political shows, write columns and do all this political stuff. And let's face it, it's because people know me. And maybe the interest is, oh, my God, he's got this crazy show. But, yeah, that's right. He was the mayor of Cincinnati and You know, so I, you know, I'm at all the Democratic conventions. I'm constantly. So it's given me an opportunity to do that as well as other things. And, you know, I enjoy entertaining. I don't mean to, you know, put a damper on that. Entertaining is fun. But I don't. It's not a passion. That's all I'm saying.
Do you think you're better at it than you were when you started?
Well, everybody's better at whatever they're doing after they've done it for a while, so I imagine that's true. I think as you get older, I don't think you could do my, I couldn't do my show if I were in my 30s because that would be competitive. People accept me doing my show, the kids, because that's our audience, young people. They accept me because I'm not a threat to them. You know, they're not competing with me. It's not this young guy who thinks he's cool and hot and, man, I'm, you know, I'm just, you know, I'm like your crazy uncle or your older, your dad or your grandfather. So the kids come on the show, oh, they're in the audience and they're going, Jerry, Jerry. But they see that I'm not judgmental and they can say anything in front of me, but they're not competing with me. And that makes it a much more comfortable place to be rather than this guy that thinks he's too cool, you know, for school. And there he is in the 28 years old saying, why don't I have your girlfriend? You know, that kind of thing. It's and I think that really helps. I think the age helps. So they can feel very comfortable in front of me. An older person. It's like the teacher you like, you know. It's you're just comfortable there. It's not a head-butting situation.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much for taking all this time to be on the show. I really enjoyed getting to talk to you.
No, you're easy to talk to. You ought to have a talk show.
Yeah, if you want to produce it, holler at me, okay?
Okay, I will. Okay. Hey, you take it easy.
Okay, you too, Jerry. Okay. Thank you much. That was Jerry Springer. His daytime talk show is in its 26th year. Jerry also hosts a weekly political show called the Jerry Springer Podcast. You've been listening to The Turnaround. If you like this show, tell a friend, subscribe, leave us a review in Apple Podcasts, share one of our interviews on social media, send somebody an email to tell them that you liked it, send someone a handwritten note, like a perfumed handwritten note that says they should listen to this interview podcast where an interviewer interviews interviewers about interviews. Maybe they'll subscribe. That's our whole marketing budget, folks. You can always visit MaximumFun.org to listen to our shows or grab them in your favorite podcatcher. There are also text versions of our interviews on the Columbia Journalism Review's website at CJR.org. We've got edited transcripts of everything for easy sharing. CJR is a co-presenter of this show. Their mission is to encourage excellence in journalism in the service of a free society. Amazing organization. They do amazing work. You can find it all at CJR.org, including their podcast, which is called The Kicker. All of The Turnaround's music is provided to us by Mobius Van Chockstraw. You can check him out at chopsmusic.com. The creator of The Turnaround is me, Jessen Thorne. Our producers are Kara Hart and Nick Liao. Our senior producer here at Maximum Fun is Laura Swisher. Our managing director, Vikram Chatterjee. Special thanks to Kyle Pope, Emily Erskine, and Daryl Frost for making this show a reality. We'll catch you next time on The Turnaround.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.